Welcome to A Lawyer's Guide to the Galaxy, a podcast about geek culture by lawyers with your hosts, Ben Siders and Kurt Damon.
And welcome back to A Lawyer's Guide to the Galaxy, the podcast that asks interesting questions that don't have any answers with your host, Ben Siders. That's me. And the other guy is still Kirk Damon.
That's Kirk. Hasn't he got through the enterprise?
We are intellectual property lawyers and certified geeks practicing law in St. Louis, Missouri. You can find this podcast on Twitter at LGGpod. Our stuff is on all of the platforms, which you should go to, by the way, and like, subscribe, and share this podcast with everybody so that other people who like what we do can find us. If you don't like what we do, then forget I said that. We are here today to talk about something that we kind of hint about, and it comes up in a lot of our podcast episodes about the law. We've never really dug down, I don't think, Kirk, into the nitty-gritty details of how the most commonplace everyday thing we deal with in the law works, contracts.
Yeah, we're gonna get into essentially, you know, one of those required classes your first year of law school.
First year, first semester, you take contracts. Sometimes you take two semesters of contracts.
Yep, and so it's contract is sort of a very basic principle of American law.
And so widely misunderstood, too.
Yeah, and I mean, in many respects, I think a lot of legal scholars would tell you American law exists because of contract. And the American legal system works the way it does because of contract. And effectively, that is what American law is.
Yeah, a great deal of our legal systems, our institutions, our constitution, everything about the American system of government revolves in some degree around the ability of private parties to enter into voluntary contracts, to negotiate the terms, and to be held accountable for what they've agreed to. Yeah. But this leads, of course, to unfairness over time as the big, powerful, and rich get to push down terms they don't negotiate to the rest of us. And so a bunch of doctrines have arisen for when those are enforceable and when those are not. Yep. And that's what we're going to talk about today. In this case, the big, powerful, and rich is the Wizards of the Coast. And the rest of us are gamers and content creators who have made or distributed content under the Open Gaming License.
For Dungeons & Dragons.
I think it's important to say we should cover at this point. We're going to get into some contract analysis here. And one of the sort of fundamental principles of contract is that what the contract means is what the parties intend. But in a situation like this, it's kind of hard to say what that is, right? You've got the intention of the authors of the license, but that may not be the same as the intention of the person signing it, what they think it means. So you always have this fundamental tension with a contract like this that the exact same words might mean different things in two different contracts between two different licensees and the licensor. Like in theory, it shouldn't work that way, but that's at least conceptually possible. So we're going to get into like what these terms mean and what they might mean in situation A or situation B. We should be clear at this point, that's not legal advice. It's legal analysis, I suppose, maybe, but not legal advice. So if you are a party to one of these things, you need to talk to a lawyer because exactly how this will play out in any given circumstance may vary from person to person. Even if you have very similar facts, differences in what you publish and how you publish it could matter. So if you have a dispute here, go talk to a lawyer. Do not rely on a podcast for legal advice. So we're going to do a couple things here. One, we're going to give you 60 seconds on what Dungeons & Dragons is and is not.
You don't know that, why are you listening to this podcast?
Yeah, I assume you know that, but we do have some lawyers here who might be a little bit cooler than us, just a little bit cooler than us, and maybe never played D&D in their mom's basement in high school. So we're going to give you the 30,000-foot view of that. It's important, though, because D&D has both protectable IP and things that are not really protected by any, or not clearly protected by any significant form of IP. And those arguably unprotected aspects of Dungeons & Dragons are precisely what's at issue. And this all came up last year, bigly, as former President Trump would say, because Wizards of the Coast has licensed some of this stuff under an open gaming license. And last year, they talked about maybe changing how that license worked, and people didn't like it.
Yep. And reading a little bit into sort of what happened around that, I think, you know, maybe it's worth pointing out that I think there was a discussion of changing the license. It basically didn't change.
Yeah, to my knowledge, it has not changed yet.
And that's, you know, sort of what it is that was a discussion. I think it did change. Then they sort of changed back and said, no, we're not changing it.
Then
the issue kind of dropped.
Yeah, what happened is, well, so we're going to talk about the original license, but the backdrop for this is that Wizards of the Coast started talking in December, I think, of 2022 that they're going to revise, it's called the OGL, Open Gaming License, 1.0A, I think is the version that was then active. I've got that one up on my screen right now, even magnified by 175%. Kirk and I can see the entire text on one screen. of the computer. So it is not a long or complicated license.
But keep in mind, this is a contract.
It's still a contract.
And that's a few basic contract principles, I think, you know.
Yeah, we're going to get into that.
But, you know, this is a contract, and this is a contract about Wizards of the Coast content. This is not just Dungeons and Dragons. It's Wizards of the Coast content.
Yes, this can be used for anything. Although, as it's written, it definitely is meant to cover D&D.
Yeah.
But Wizards of the Coast was going to update and revise this. They said that a bunch of things... Oh, let's back up. This contract was used by a bunch of third-party content creators to make their own original Dungeons & Dragons compatible content, including games, software, products, YouTube channels. There's one called Critical Role. I think it's like an audiovisual production of like people playing D&D. So a lot of content got created using this license. Some of these businesses are worth millions now and produce millions of dollars in revenue per year. Wizards of the Coast came out and said, you know, we never meant for this to result in multi-million dollar direct competitors who were making video games. It was meant to just be supplementary to pencil and paper. So we're going to fix that by rewriting this license to say we get some of that money and you can't do a lot of this stuff. And as you might imagine, the disobedient sector of the internet said, like hell you're going to.
Well, and I think the real thing to keep in mind about Dungeons & Dragons from our point of view here is Dungeons & Dragons is a core system for how to play the game.
Yeah.
Most of what we're talking about is things which use that game system to essentially facilitate their own, you know, story content, whatever you want to call it. Those things have been published. They've been, you know, and this is not something new. This has pretty much existed since Dungeons and Dragons has existed.
Let's talk about what D&D is. It's in a broad category of tabletop gaming, but it's not a board game. That's kind of a common misunderstanding for people who've never played. D&D is basically a bunch of rule books and sometimes some like fantasy settings with some background information, but it's essentially a set of game mechanics. Here's how you create, just like if you played a video game where you create a character, D&D is the pencil and paper version of that. You get a sheet of paper out with a bunch of blanks to fill in. You pick whether you're going to be an elf or a dwarf or a human, or you're going to be a wizard, a fighter, or a thief. You roll some dice to determine what your starting stats are instead of using the computer to generate random numbers. You pick out some gear and some equipment, all the stuff you do when you make a character in like an online game. And then somebody who is basically serving the same role as the computer narrates the game to you, explains what's going on, and you make decisions and roll dice to decide the outcome of those decisions. And the rule books are basically collections of stats, data, rule mechanics, how things work, how much damage this sword does, how much hit points this monster has, all the same stuff that in a video game the computer just knows and keeps track of for you. In D&D, the books contain those rules, and the dungeon master is the player who's playing the game with you and kind of, I don't know how to just say it, curating all of this.
The way I oftentimes describe Dungeons and Dragons role-playing games generally as cooperative storytelling.
Yeah, that's a good way.
And the real way, the idea behind it is that what you really have is you have a games master who's giving you the storyline.
Mm-hmm.
You have the players who are the character who are playing the characters in the story.
Hence role-playing game.
Hence role-playing, kind of being like, you know, an improv troupe making it up as they go along. The purpose of the rule books is to give guardrails.
Yeah.
And so you bump into the issue of basically like, okay, well, if I say I want my character to lie to this person and get away with it, you have role-playing where it's the how well can you do it as the actor playing the person. But most people don't want to play that way. It wants to be, I want to play a character who is a swindler and is really good at this.
Yeah.
And so what the idea behind the dice rolling is to say, well, somebody may have a 18%, you know, 18 out of 20 chance of successfully lying. You roll the dice to see whether or not you correctly roll that you do successfully do it.
The dice are there to introduce really some guardrails, as you said, but also some dramatic tension about whether you're going to be successful or something or not. If you've ever played D&D and rolled a natural 20, when you have like a 1% chance to win something, which is an automatic hit no matter what, people literally stand up and cheer. It's exciting.
Yeah, the example I use, I play a game, Top Secret, which is about spy games. I got to roll a similar type of mechanics. I got to roll a natural 20. I was being chased down the ski slope, not knowing how to ski, and inadvertently went off a ski jump and rolled a natural 20, meaning I did a flip and landed on my skis. You know, so it's those kind of things that you bump into. The real thing about it is people who have not actually played a role-playing game oftentimes find the rule books very weird.
Yeah, they're kind
to look at, because they're being these guardrails and they're portraying all this. This is what this thing does. This is how it works. And it's all written in dice rolls and stuff like that. the reason that's done is because sort of once you start doing role playing and you get into the character of this, you understand what those things mean.
Yeah. So one of the first things we're going to talk about here is with that context in mind, what does this open gaming license do? So once I've bought these rule books and I understand what the rules are, it doesn't take long when you're playing role-playing games that you have ideas for your own. It's usually called an adventure if you're doing like one quick session, yep, or a campaign if you design a whole epic storyline like a Lord of the Rings type, yep, thing over that your players all play over multiple sessions that has sort of an overarching narrative theme and goals to accomplish and things like that. So, but once you've done a couple of these, you quickly realize how much fun it is to design your own. And almost all of us who play D&D have at some point at least designed our own adventures. Yep. And then you run your players through it. That's not a big deal. You don't need an open gaming license for that. Everybody's been doing that since D&D came out in the 70s. But what if I want to sell my adventures to other people because they're just so good, other people want to buy copies from
them? No, I think it is important to note that there is some, arguably concern about the idea of generating any content, even if you don't sell it. Is there a need for a license? And I think most people would look at it and say, in some sense, the purpose of these games is for you to do this. They actively promote you doing this. They discuss how to do it. But the issue you bump into, particularly with copyright law, is it can be so pervasive. Could you bump into a scenario where even what the company is encouraging you to do technically comprises a copyright violation if they choose to make it one? And so a lot of times they put these kind of licenses into place to say, look, yeah, we know we're okay with this. This is part of, yep, what we're selling is your ability to do this. When they do that, you then bump into the next stage, which is okay, we're okay with you doing it because that's part of the game. But then what if you make a business out of it? And that's usually where these licenses kind of live and where the lines have to be drawn, which is doing this at some level is an essential part of the game. Doing it at a second level is a commercial activity, which isn't really essential to the game. What is the underlying creator? And I'm not going to say rights holder, but underlying creator's intention with this. Do they want to allow the former and not the latter? Do they want to allow both? Do they want to disallow both? That's the kind of problem you bump into. And I think what you usually would bump into is they want to allow the former but disallow the latter. So it's we want you to do it, but only in the aspect of doing it with our stuff for your friends, yep, not selling it. But those two in the real world tend to run together. So they put these contracts into place to try to demarcate them.
And one of the reasons why this is a concern is that a major source of revenue for originally TSR, now Wizards of the Coast, is writing up these adventures and campaigns and content. And they've developed these universes over time that are extremely valuable. So the original D&D universe was called Greyhawk. They've also launched Forgotten Realms. Dragonlance is a big one. We tweet with Margaret Weiss from Dragonlance online. Everyone's, we tried to get her on the podcast and she said no. Or rather, her agent said no, unfortunately. She kind of thought, I thought we'd get her on based on our Twitter interactions. But we actually have talked to her before about some IP issues online. But anyway, Dragonlance, there's...
Baldur's Gate.
That's part of... I think that's Forgotten Realms.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah, if you saw the D&D movie that just came out, I think that takes place in the Forgotten Realms universe, I think.
What's this winter or something, isn't it?
Neverwinter Nights.
Neverwinter Nights.
That's also part of Forgotten Realms, I believe. There's a whole bunch of them. There's there's one that takes place on like a burnt out planet. There's all kinds of different settings. There's one that's like in Mesoamerica, tons of them. So they hire professional artists, they write fiction books, and they produce these campaigns and have all this sort of really creative narrative content that they sell and make money off of. So if somebody else is coming up with their own original settings that work with the D&D rule set and are selling it, they are, in a sense, competing with Wizards of the Coast for the same dollars.
Yep. Yeah, because you can have third parties who come in and develop and say, hey, I'm going to use this game system, but I'm going to develop my own thing, which you've never contemplated. I'm going to have mine set on a lonely island, which doesn't really exist anywhere else, in conjunction with it. But here's all my content, and you have the content creation around it. I think the key thing to keep in mind behind this is, in some sense, this is encouraged, because of the fact that, even if you're playing in Greyhawk, not all of Greyhawk is discussed. There's cities which have no detail provided.
Yep.
This is true of any of these large immersive universes. You don't just encounter this here. I mean, to use as the example, this is the Star Wars universe. There are large expanse. It is an entire galaxy. There are huge components of it which have never been in detail explored.
Have we ever seen Sullust? Only
have ever seen Sullust. Have we ever seen a story about how the Wolf Man in the cantina, yeah, actually what his planet's from and what he does? We've never seen these things. There's huge amounts of stuff sort of in the background, and in the in all of these things, we often have to talk about this as fan fiction. In the role-playing game scenario, it's particularly interesting because of the fact that this fiction, this storytelling, is an integral aspect of the game. This is not me creating a book somebody would read. This is an integral aspect of the game, and you use the game to play in this, whether you're using Wizards of the Coast-created content or your own created content. You're ultimately playing the same game.
So this license was an attempt, it was published in 2000, I think. It's an old license. It's been around for a while. But it
recognizing that's like 30 years after the creation of Dungeons & Dragons.
Yes, but it was, here it is, copyright 2000 Wizards of the Coast. So this license was an attempt to make it easier and weirdly clearer about what you can and cannot do with the D&D property. But Kirk and I were reading it right before we sat down to record, and we're not convinced it actually accomplishes what it set out to accomplish. And there's actually an argument, which has never been tested in court, that you can do everything this license grants without accepting it. So let's go through it. Here's what the license says. What it purports to do is say, well, start with this. It says that in consideration for agreeing to use this license, the contributors, we'll talk about what that means in just a second, grant you a, these are important words, perpetual, worldwide, royalty-free, non-exclusive license with the exact terms of this license to use the open game content.
One thing to know, we can't really do this because it's an audio podcast. An important aspect of contracts is that many terms are capitalized.
Yes.
A capitalized term in a contract typically is a defined term. So it's a term that has a particular meaning within the contract, which is expressly given in the yes. definitions. So in this case, there's a few defined terms here, one of which is contributors, one of which is you, another one of which is license to use, this particular reference, this license, and another one of which is open game content. So keep in mind, if you listen to that sentence, if you jump back and listen to that sentence, about half the words and pretty much all the major ones are words expressly defined in this contract.
I'll try to link to this in the show notes so that if you want, you can pull the license up and follow along with what we're doing. So let's talk about those definitions. Contributors is defined as the copyright and or trademark owners who have contributed open game content.
And again, it's not surprising that a definition refers to another definition.
So open game content, and this is where this gets really interesting, means the game mechanic and includes the methods, procedures, processes, and routines to the extent such content does not embody the, capitalized term, product identity, and is an enhancement over the prior art, curious term, and any additional content clearly identified as open game content by the contributor, and means any work covered by this license, including translations and derivative works under copyright law, but specifically excludes product identity. That's a mouthful.
It's a mouthful, but I think the real key thing to keep in mind out of this is we are making a distinction between two different things.
Yes.
Open game content and product identity. Those are mutually exclusive. And, you know, so one does not mean the other.
Yep.
And they are the only two options.
Yes. Something is either product identity or open game content. It cannot be both.
Yes.
So what is product identity, Kirk? It's a very, very long definition. We can sum it up pretty succinctly. It's all the copyright stuff.
And
it's
in some sense, the trademark stuff.
Product line names, logos, identifying marks, trade dress, artifacts, creatures, characters, stories, storylines, plots, thematic elements, dialogue, incidents, language, artwork, symbols, designs, depictions. I'm only a third of the way through this, okay?
Yeah.
So it's all of the creative content and none of the rules, which is what is open game content. Open game content is methods,
game
procedures,
mechanics,
processes, routines, game mechanics. Okay, so we've got a pretty clear dividing line between the game rules and the creative content.
So if we say Greyhawk and is a setting, that would seem to be
product identity
without any question.
If we say the D20 system, we're talking about open game content, the mechanics of the game.
Or rolling a D20 or rolling a charisma roll, to use as an example.
Yep.
You know, we are probably talking about open game content. Now there's a little bit of overlap there because the concept, like the fact that it's called charisma, which is, I believe, a specific D&D term, as opposed to being called, for example, you know, like ability,
personality
or something like that.
Likeability.
You know, there could be some rights in that. But the idea of saying I'm rolling a D20 dice to determine whether or not something happens is clearly open game content, the game mechanics.
So let's flip over to a different concept here for a second. Why do we need a license in the first place?
Well, presumably the reason why this license exists is because you're going to use either trademarked or copyrighted content. Now, it could involve patented content, but let's face it, Dungeons & Dragons is way too old. There are no patents here, so that's not relevant to this. It could be in other scenarios, but it's not here.
Not here.
So we're taking copyright and trademarked content.
So the trademark content is clearly in the product identity, so that's not what's being licensed.
Yeah, I mean, I think without any question.
So that means the question is, what IP is being licensed to us under the open game content part of the license?
And it really feels like the copyright is listed, you know, copyright material is listed in that product identity too, right? I mean, it sort of sounds that way.
So here's the question. Is the mechanics itself copyrighted and being licensed to us under this document? So to answer that, we're going to turn to 17 U.S.C. Section 102B.
I think the thing we're looking at is what are game mechanics?
What kind of IP is that? It could be patented, but it's not.
Yes. And I think that is an important aspect here to keep in mind. Game mechanics can be patented.
It's very difficult.
It's difficult. It's something we kind of do as a specialized practice. I mean, you know, the two of us,
we've done it before.
We've done it before. But it's one of those where the question, the key in this is there is no patent here.
Yes.
Now, there could be, but there is not. So let's leave that, you know, that's an important fact.
So that leaves us with, and it can't be trade secret because it's been published.
It's been published.
So we only have one major category of IP left, and that's copyright.
Yep.
But the Copyright Act says, and like I said, 17 U.S.C. Section 102B, in no case does copyright protection for an original work of authorship extend to any idea, procedure, process, system, method of operation, concept, principle, or discovery, regardless of the form in which it is described, explained, illustrated, or embodied in such work. Going back to the license, game content is methods, procedures, processes, and routines.
That's exactly the same language.
So it's almost like they read the Copyright Act and said, we're going to define the stuff we're licensing to you as the stuff we don't own any rights to.
Yeah.
That's bizarre.
And that's the thing that I think is the most interesting about this, and this is what really sort of started our discussion, and a lot of the reason why we're doing this podcast, is what we have here is a clear distinction, open game content or product identity. You have a license to open game content. You do not have a license to product identity. The problem you bump into is it seems like everything that you need a license to is product identity, and everything you don't is open game content, because it's specifically what's excluded from copyright protection, which is really our protection here. Now, as I just want to point out, there is a little bit of a complicating factor here in the fact that by sort of necessity, the writing which explains open game content is covered by copyright because it's expressive.
Yes.
Even though it's describing a concept and the copyright can't cover the concept.
Yeah.
So you can express the same complication there.
You can express the same concept using your own original expression.
That was my comment with the idea of calling it charisma versus calling it personality can have a different meaning. Where exactly that line lies, we could probably do an 8-hour podcast on, you know, what exactly does it mean and where does that copyright line lie? But the real key to it is there is a little bit of copyright bleeding over into how do you express things to which you copyright does not cover can be a copyright issue. And again, there's a whole series of law. We talked about the copyrightability of phone books and things like that previously. You know, those are things where you bump into that, and we need to just sort of point out that that's there, and we're not really going to go into it. But when we're talking about the underlying thing, the game mechanic, not any expression of the game mechanic, the game mechanic.
I can't photocopy the player's handbook and distribute that. That is copyrighted, but the rules themselves are not. It specifically says in the Copyright Act, no matter how you describe them, you don't own the rules.
Exactly.
So looking at this, stepping back from the document, Kirk, if I want to make my own D&D compatible original setting, why do I need this license at all?
Well, presumably the one concern I think you bump into with it is what you'd be worried about if I was going to create my own thing is using D&D as a name.
But this doesn't give me the right to do that anyway.
Yeah, and that's the right. Those are the things I think you'd be most worried about. You know,
in fact, it says in Section 7, you agree not to use any product identity, which would include the brand name, including as an indication as to compatibility, unless you've got a separate license to do that. So it specifically says I can't even say D&D compatible under this license.
Yeah.
Okay, why don't I just say, you know what? I do not accept the license. Now I have not agreed to not say it's compatible, and so now I can say it's compatible.
And that's kind of the weirdness is the no we bump into is it's can I say it's compatible without a license? And arguably, yes,
there
depending
is
on how
some
you
law.
Phrase it.
Yeah, as long as you're not implying some false association or we also have dilution and tarnishment. But generally speaking, it is possible to do that in a way that does not offend trademark rights.
But you also then bump into, and I think anybody who's sort of involved in these is you can also bump into people who say, this is a D20 system compatible thing. Now, D20 system does not say Dungeons & Dragons, but Dungeons & Dragons is a D20 system. There are lots of other D20 systems, too. It's worth pointing that out. Systems that use, when we say D20, for those of you who may not be quite as nerdy as we are, that means a 20-sided dice. You use 20-sided dice. Yes, there are 20-sided dice, just in case you didn't know that. But yeah, that's what you really bump into in conjunction with this is what it sounds like my biggest concern in doing this type of content is saying it works with Dungeons & Dragons, which this license doesn't allow me to do.
Yeah, so I guess I'm struggling a little bit. I'm looking up D20 system right now. There are a bunch of abandoned registrations from Wizards of the Coast on role-playing game equipment as applied to the D20 system. So I'm not sure if they tried to get that copyright or trademarked and were not able to. But it looks like their applications were rejected. Oh, no, they didn't renew it. In 2023, they did not renew their D20 system. So maybe version 6 is not going to use D20. So anyway, the point is, though, this license does not grant you the right to say compatible, which would be valuable. So in fact, it says you cannot do that. And what it does grant you the right to use based on the language of the Copyright Act doesn't really seem like they own any IP to it anyway. So as a threshold level, it's a little puzzling what this does for you as a content distributor, other than it is at least a contract with Wizards of the Coast. And so it makes it more difficult for them to come after you and say, you're doing things that we don't allow and we have some kind of rights of some kind. They can basically, they're big, you're not. They can muddy it up and make it difficult.
And I think that's the worst of the thing behind this. To pull back for a second, let's stop picking on Wizards of the Coast in particular. But sort of do the thing behind this is, why do these things get created and why are they out there? The answer to it is, in many respects, is we've talked about we have multiple issues in conjunction with this podcast on fan fiction and exactly what is licensed, what is not, fan-created products, stuff like that. What these usually exist as is these are an attempt, and I'm going to really use the word attempt, by the underlying rights holder, by a company who owns rights. There is no question yes. Wizards of the Coast owns rights in Dungeons & Dragons of various forms, of various things behind that. They own those. What that they would like people to be able to use in certain ways and not use in certain other ways in an area where the law is ambiguous. And that's what we're really talking about is this is not well-established law. This is an area where the law is ambiguous. So what they do is they try to write a license to say, look, if you do these things, we're okay with them. If you do these other things, we're not okay with them. That's why they do this. In addition, that gives the fans or the potential content creators some indication that at least to the extent they can look at the license and say, is what I'm doing in compliance with the license? Yes, it is. Therefore, I'm fine versus I'm not in compliance with the license and I'm going to have to rely upon other IP principles or other grounds for defense. And that presents my potential concern. The real concern with these is, and what we're kind of getting at with this is a very simple license, usually probably written this way in order to make it clear.
Admirably simple.
Admirably simple. But to make it simple that the average non-lawyer can understand this. But us sitting here in the course of being two lawyers looking at this, we don't necessarily understand exactly what it means.
Yeah, the strategy here is not clear.
I would venture to say this is not the only example we could readily find of this.
No, this is open source licenses for software have this problem. This does look like it was probably written by a lawyer, but I'm not trying to besmirch anybody here, but probably not one that specializes in IP, just based on mixing up some concepts. Like it mentions prior art in the definition of open game content. Prior art's a patent term.
It's a very much term of art in patent.
Yeah. So it doesn't really make sense as used here when they're trying to describe copyrighted stuff, because then they also get into derivative work, which is definitely a copyright concept, not a patent concept. So there's some kind of mixing up of terminology here. Not that it's inappropriate to say prior art, because you could patent game rules. You and I have done it.
Yep.
But the way they've used it here kind of implies a blending of concepts. And going back to the definition of contributor, that's meant to capture Wizards of the Coast and its contractors. Open game content, contributor means the copyright and or trademark owners who have contributed open game content. So it doesn't say patent owners or inventors.
Yeah.
But it says copyright and trademark owners who have contributed open game content. But open game content is defined to exclude copyrightable or trademarkable material. So who are the contributors then? It doesn't make any sense.
And again, I think the real point of just sort of what we want to get at with this, and again, we're kind of picking on Wizards of the Coast here.
We're not picking Wizards of the Coast. They're admirably trying to find a way to do this and to keep bit simple.
Yeah.
Because Kirk and I often say, unfortunately, these legal principles are not simple. And when you try and dumb it down, you get these kind of ambiguities.
Yep. And what, and again, I would say that this is not going to be alone. I suspect we can go out and find a number of other companies generating game content of this type, you know, role-playing game content, tabletop gaming content, things that have immersive universes, which in some sense, the goal of them is to draw the player into their universe and to, you know, create this, again, what I call cooperative storytelling type of environments. They probably all have these kind of issues in
Yes.
them.
We do a lot of litigation and dispute resolution over licenses written in the 90s and early 2000s. The sophistication of license drafting has changed over time. They've gotten bigger and longer, more complicated. It is not at all unusual industry-wide to encounter licenses written in this time period that are about like this. So this is definitely not us picking on Wizards of the Coast. This is kind of a typical drafting paradigm for this time frame.
Yeah, and I think that's important to keep in mind because it's what we really want to try to focus on here behind this is, and when we're talking, when we then had a dispute over the change of these license terms, one of the issues we had, and one we haven't necessarily pointed out sort of specifically in conjunction with this, is changing these license terms and the ability to change them
that's
isn't
tricky.
Clear under this license
yeah.
either.
So that's where this dispute came up, is Wizards of the Coast wanted to update and clarify this license. And as we've just pointed out, that's a good idea, because this license is now very old and unclear. The problem is, now it's time to talk about contract principles. You can't just publish a new license and say, now everybody is stuck with it. If you've already got a license in place,
you're entitled to rely upon a license you've already agreed to staying in place to the extent the contract itself says it stays in place.
So let's talk about contract law 101. This is the stuff you learn on the first day of contract. To form a valid contract, you need really four things: offer, acceptance, capacity, and consideration.
Yep.
Capacity means that you are age of majority and you're
capable of actually agreeing
and that
to
you are of sound mind and can form a contract. So that you can just assume that's the case.
You don't have a
here.
Gun to your head is another example and say you agree to it, you can't be coerced, things like that.
Consideration is a law school concept that we're not going to get into in much detail, but it basically means that there's an exchange of promises. It differentiates a contract from just a unilateral promise to do something, which is not enforceable by itself.
The other thing you bump into is that it has to have some value.
Yeah.
So we can't agree to something which is valueless to both parties and then say it's enforceable.
Correct. So the real nut of this is offer and acceptance. Something is an offer if it is something that you've done or said that a reasonable person would understand that if they accepted that offer, they've made a bargain. They formed a deal.
Well, let's just quickly, as we say that, what is a contract? A contract is an agreement that agrees to be legally enforceable. That's part of the thing of agreeing to a contract is that you agree that its terms are legally enforceable. And again, that's even that is, you know, multiple weeks of contracts course when you're in, you know, law school 101. But the real behind it is we're saying we intend to form a contract. I think most people have a general concept of if I'm in a contract, I'm bound by it. If you want to get into a really good discussion of like the concerns with the general understanding of what it means from a contract, I invite you to actually listen to, there's a couple great episodes out there talking about Ursula's contract with the Little Mermaid.
Yes.
And whether or not that's an enforceable contract and whether what it teaches us about contract law, both right and wrong.
Fraud and the inducement.
that's a great way to learn about it. We haven't put out those contents. There's a number of other podcasts and things that have put out content on that. Those are a really good way to look at it because it's something where the contract is central to that movie and is a great way to look at it. So that's why we're not going to go into it here. But what we really have, and to Ben's point, we have to have somebody say, I am offering you a contract that is a contract. That's what offer means.
Yeah.
It is a contract and I am telling you that I agree to it if you agree to it.
So examples of things that are non-contracts, like I've said to Kirk before, like, well, if blah, blah, blah happens, I'll eat my hat, you know, something like that, which is an obvious saying that everybody understands. You don't literally mean that. So, or if somebody says, you know, if somebody, I told my kids the other day, if somebody brings me a Coke, I'll buy you a pony.
Yeah.
Okay. So one of my kids ran off and got me a soda, but that's not a valid contract.
They
don't reasonably believe that's actually going to happen. So, you know, you have to say something that sounds like you mean it and that if I accept it, that I would reasonably expect to have formed a bargain. And likewise, acceptance is conduct that manifests an intent to accept such an offer, again, to a reasonable person. So if you say, oh, sure, I'll do that in a really sarcastic way, that, you know, conveys that you don't mean it, it's not necessarily an acceptance. But But the key to all of this is that the people who are offering and accepting the contract must have a meeting of the minds on what the terms are.
Yeah, that's again, a really big thing sort of you bump into in general contract law, which is we have, in order for there to be a contract, we have to have agreed on what the contract is. And quite frankly, if you were to get into disputes over contract, my argument would be 80% of all contract disputes are, did we actually agree and understand the terms to be the same thing? And that's a very common thing in conjunction with you get into scenarios where people propose things. My favorite one to do it is it's the, you see me driving a Ferrari and I say, I'll sell you my car for $50. You give me $50 and I sell you a Pinto that I've owned for 30 years. Well, you thought it was a Ferrari, but I said a car, not a Ferrari. Is there a meeting of the minds? No, there's not. That's the first example of there not being a meeting of the minds. I intended to scam you and you did not, you know, and you thought I was saying something else. That's a perfect sort of example of a non-meeting of the minds.
So let's look at what this license says. Let's say we've accepted the original OpenGL, OGL license. It says by its terms that I get a perpetual license right there. Grant you a perpetual worldwide license. And under termination, it says it terminates automatically if I fail to comply. And I don't cure, that's a term of art, I don't cure that breach within 30 days.
Yeah, cure is basically meaning that I fix any non-compliance.
And all sub-licenses, so survive the termination of this license. So even if I breach this license, if I've already granted the rights to my own customers of my custom content, those licenses are still good, even if this one's gone.
And unsurprisingly, you have a cure period. That's normal. You know, to have some things with this.
Otherwise, it doesn't terminate.
And I think a key element to keep in mind, the term perpetual has a distinct meaning in copyright law, which truly means forever.
Forever, yeah.
I mean, that's really what that term means in copyright law. If you grant somebody a perpetual license, it means it lasts forever until effectively the contract is terminated by its own terms.
Yeah, the only way it can be undone is if there is, one, a breach. If I breach the license terms that grant that, then it can be undone. Or if me and the person who granted agree to cancel it.
Yeah, and that's one of, again, those sort of key things when we talk about the idea of what is a contract. Contracts typically include their own requirements to end the contract. So it says, we have this agreement, we're going to do this. We also have as part of the agreement how we end this agreement. Now, there are defaults that can allow you to end it, what we're calling breach. That's effectively things that are outside of the agreement in this contract that causes the contract to fail to exist, which is basically one party not behaving the way they're supposed to. But so an example of like a breach you oftentimes see is that if one of the parties says, hey, I'm going to supply you with a product and then doesn't do it, that can be considered a breach, even though it hasn't terminated the contract by its own terms. It terminates the contract. Terminating by its own terms is somebody to say, I'm going to do this. But if we decide mutually that we don't want to do this anymore, then we don't have to, and that terminates the contract. Keep in mind, the agreement of the two parties of a contract or any parties of a contract to no longer both enforce the contract is effectively a separate agreement.
Yeah. You can always agree to cancel anything.
Cancel the contract.
So that brings up an important point, which is that the terms of the contract are important because it says what you get to do, whether or not the other party is willing to agree to
it. Yes, and that's really what it is that if I say you can terminate in 30 days notice for any reason, it truly means you can terminate in 30 days.
Even if the other party doesn't want to.
Even if the answer is I hate you and things like that, the other party's like, but this is going to cost me $1 million. Well, too bad. That's the term of the contract.
So the question is, when Wizards of the Coast came out with version 1.1, they said that this version of the contract is no longer authorized or will no longer be authorized, and only the new version will be. And this threw the content creators into a tailspin because they had to completely redo their businesses, which were built on this contract, to use the new one. And the question Kirk and I had is, one, but do they really?
Well,
how do you get that new contract to stick?
Is the tailspin important? I think it's sort of the thing we had with it. And part of it is, regardless of what they were being advised by their legal counsel, regardless of what they thought they needed to do, what we really had is we had a social media frenzy discussing this and what did it mean. And that's what we really kind of want to get at, is outside of any legal bounds of what would any content creator do, which is going to depend on exactly how their business runs, anything else, what do we have with it? And the interesting thing behind this is you have this contract saying this is a perpetual contract. There's basically no ground for termination barring breach. So sort of those kind of things. But if you've already created content underneath this, can it be terminated? And the answer appears to kind of be no. Now, it's no longer authorized. There's discussions in the idea of what does authorized mean in this contract.
Which, to preview where we're going with this, I would say, so what?
Yeah. But the I think there's an argument to say you can't say something I create after this is unauthorized is under this contract. I think that would be the one thing that you could say with it.
And the way you usually deal with this, like in software, is in the original contract, you say, we may, we being the licensor, we may from time to time publish new contract terms. And by continuing to use the software, you have agreed to those contract terms. This is what we call a unilateral contract, where we say, if you do X, then you agree to Y. Courts will enforce those for the most part.
Yes.
For the most part. But they will look at them a lot closer than they will another type of contract, particularly because these are what we call contracts of adhesion. That's where it is a contract where the terms are written by one party with all the bargaining power, and it is a take-it-or-leave-it contract where the other party has no choice.
And the reason why this matters is, remember we talked about one of those things you have to have is a lack of coercion? There's an argument in conjunction with this that by saying, hey, if you're going to, if you become dependent upon using my product, I can now force you to change the contract terms because of that dependence. Doesn't that sound like coercion? Yeah.
So, for example, Vizio, I've got a Vizio TV. They recently rolled out new terms of service.
Yep.
And it disabled my entire TV until I agreed to accept those terms of service. So they've already got my money. I've paid for the TV and now I can't use it unless I accept a new contract. Okay, there are some legally troubling aspects of that. Now, I just clicked through it because I don't care what it says, whether it's either it's binding or not, right? So, and I want to use my TV, which is what most people do. But that's exactly why courts are reluctant to enforce those very strictly. And the more onerous and unreasonable the terms are, the less likely a court is to actually enforce
it. A lot of times what the courts will do is they'll look and say, why were the changes made? Are essentially the changes being made for a legitimate reason? Yeah. Or are they being made because they're trying to coerce you?
The law has changed and they need to update the terms to comply with the new law. Okay, that's fair.
And I think most places sort of look at that. But keep in mind, like that's a common thing, that sort of unilateral contract. Just as a point, more than likely, some of our listeners today agreed to a unilateral contract.
Oh, we do it almost every day.
By using something.
Every time you go to a website, you accept the terms of service. So the question is, by publishing that, do they necessarily amend this one? And I think our conclusion is probably not. It says in Section 9 of 1.0, wizards or its agents may publish updated versions of this license. Okay, I publish away. But that doesn't mean that I've accepted those published versions unless something in here says that by continuing to offer or sell my content, I've accepted whatever those published versions are. It doesn't say that. It says, you may use any authorized version of this license to copy, modify, or distribute any open game content originally distributed under any version of this license. That does suggest that I have to use an authorized version. But authorized by who? I guess we'd assume Wizards. But if I've already sold all this stuff, the license has already been granted to my customers, and this license has already been granted to me. I'm not sure that sentence is enough to say that by them just saying that this version is no longer authorized, that I can no longer distribute the same content I've already been offering and distributing under this license before. Now, it might apply to new stuff going forward. I think there's a better argument for that, but I'm not convinced it can work retroactively. What do you think?
It's one of these where I think the problem you get into with this is where, and this is where we sort of commented about, this is the advantage of the 15-page license over the one-page license. The 15-page license can clarify these ambiguities. What we're talking about in conjunction with this is ambiguities. Does this or does this not apply to existing content and go backwards? It's unclear. It's not whether or not it does or doesn't. We don't know the answer to that question. And just to sort of, sort of reiterate the cognitive disclaimer, like this can't be legal advice because we literally can't talk about it.
Yeah.
In that respect, it's the question what we're trying to focus on is the fact that these ambiguities exist, and these ambiguities exist because of the fact that this is a short license.
It is. It's short. And the law in this area is also not very well shored up.
And what also caused people to investigate this ambiguity was the attempt to clarify this.
Yes. Well, and then it also gets to the higher question. So what if I don't want to accept a new license? Like we said at the outset, it's not clear that this license grants you rights to any actual
IP.
So could you just say, I decline your new license, and I'm not going to follow the old one.
I decline all your licenses.
Yeah.
And around it. And that's an interesting scenario. And it's one of those where, again, what we see around this, and I think in some sense why this has become such an issue, is if we get back into the 1980s, we get back into the 1970s, none of this mattered. We can, in many respects, blame George Lucas for this and his Star Wars licensing of toys, which actually made money for what is sort of the first time in a movie's history, suddenly created this issue of what does it mean to have IP in these universes, these creations, these larger than an individual work type of thing. That's kind of when this came into being, and it's an area the law has struggled with and is continuing to struggle with. And private actors are having trouble with this, rights holders are having trouble with this, and people who want to use rights they can use and not use rights they are not allowed to use. These are people who are trying to do what they can legitimately, don't know what to do in conjunction with this. So that's really what we have here, is we have an issue where we have, and again, to sort of pull back and look at what we're commenting about here, we have an issue where we have law change, we have ambiguous license that's indicative of its time period, we have attempt to clarify license with better understanding, resulting in a firestorm of unclarity because of both the two original ambiguities and the attempt to clarify. How, as a legal scheme, do we deal with this?
It's very difficult, particularly because the majority of the people accepting these licenses are not lawyers, and they're not going to hire lawyers. So Wizards of the Coast, both with this license and with the new one, I did look at it, it's 15 pages long, made an admirable attempt to write the license using the correct legal language, which is important to use the right terminology, but to write it in a way that's understandable to non-attorneys. But the problem is, I've tried to do that too. It's really difficult to do because the more you write it for lay people, the less clear it is, weirdly enough.
Well, and part of that is because it's terms like, I sort of picked on that term perpetual, you know, real quick in conjunction with it. That term has legal meaning, so that's why it's used, but that's not necessarily the way a non-lawyer understands it. But using a different term, a lawyer is likely to look at it and say, well, why didn't you use the term perpetual if that's what you meant? And so you end up with kind of these conflicts behind it. And again, that's kind of the pullback. And I think the point of what we're trying to get across in this thing is we had a firestorm get created around this, recognizing that that entire firestorm may be premised on the wrong premise.
And yeah,
behind it. How do we deal as lawyers, as people just going forward in this area, with the fact that we may have we need something to be understood when there's no possibility of it necessarily being understood in the way it needs to be? And how do we deal with that legally? That's a bigger legal question, just contract, but this happens to be an area that really, really makes it clear.
Yeah. And one final point to make is that Wizards of the Coast did, or at least last I knew, scaled back on what they wanted to change, and to my knowledge has not launched that next version
yet. Yeah, they've actually pulled back all the way to this version and said this version still is so binding and still is the appropriate version.
Not all licensors do that. Sometimes they just double down and get even more stubborn. So it does seem like the community here, and D&D is famous and defined by its community, was effective here in saying, look, this isn't fair. You can't do this. We're not going to put up with it. And to their credit, Wizards of the Coast has so far listened and seems to have reached some kind of peace. I'm not sure where exactly this stands. Hopefully there's a well-actually person out there who can tell us where this is.
Yeah. And yeah, I think the thing, just as we end this episode to talk about it, it's important to note that, you know, we've talked a lot about what we think this contract means. This is not legal advice, you know.
No, we don't know. Nobody knows is the truth. We can look at this and say, this may be good enough, this may not be good enough, but nobody knows until a judge or a jury comes back and says this.
It also matters a lot of what it is you're doing and how does that apply, because that also interacts with what are the other areas of law that are interfaced. So we put that as a disclaimer on the end of every one of our episodes, but I think it's important to call it out specifically because you can't look at this and say, hey, they said that this is what this term means, because we didn't. You know, the whole idea where, again, what we're trying to focus on this is the fact that we have ambiguity, which just simply exists, and then trying to deal with the ambiguity in the law creates ambiguity itself. And just how does the law deal with that? And that, again, I think that's the sort of point of what we have here is when we've talked about these things in the past, that there is ambiguity, resolving the ambiguity is also not necessarily easy.
No, and no matter how big and long the contract is, there will always be some ambiguity somewhere. If there wasn't, there would be no contract.
There'd be no lawyers. Yeah.
Okay, that's all for this time. We'll see you next time. Borum, play us out.
The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by, Lewis Rice LLC, its officers, directors, employees, agents, representatives, shareholders, and subsidiaries. None of the content should be considered legal advice. As always, consult a lawyer. This podcast was produced and recorded in St. Louis, Missouri.